Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Project Scars podcast. My name is Seth Miersma, and joining me today is one fewer floating head than we usually have on this podcast, but it's a glorious one, Mr. Kyle Hyatt.
It's a giant one, I'll tell you that much.
Big old noggin on that guy, full of brains.
I got to pay my haberdasher overtime. Woo!
That's where you keep all the hottest of takes, right? In your large cranium, huh?
Or slightly misremembered Fugazi lyrics, either or.
Also very important. Yeah.
Yeah, it's critical. It's,
the information that we forget is some of the most entertaining that we've actually ever had. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. We are happy to be here for episode 6 of the Project Scars podcast. We're aiming directly at double digits, and I know that we can make it. Before we get
literally tens of people.
Tens of people, tens of episodes. Sooner or later, we'll have more listeners than we do episodes. I don't know when that's going to happen, but I'm excited for it.
That's the world I want to live in.
Before we hop in today, as ever, I would like to let you know that the Project Scars podcast is presented by CarID.com. Fix it, upgrade it, customize it. CarID.com is your car parts destination. And it's also brought to you by the CarID Drive blog, where you can find amazing stories about cars, owners, incredible builds, and unbelievable driving adventures. Check it out and get inspired for your next automotive project. Interesting week, interesting Wednesday thus far. Kyle, I've got to say, I freshened myself up a little pre-podcast because I had virtually zero sleep last night. Talk about single digits of hours for, well, I guess that's normal. Maybe.
As we've established, we're not great at that.
No, we're not excellent at sleeping. And last night was worse than normal. I have, as I've mentioned before on this show, I have a 3-year-old and a 5-year-old, and they sort of take turns deciding that they're going to wake us up. The 5-year-old, whose name is Jack, has been really obsessed with Michael Jackson's Thriller.
Understandable. I mean,
great song.
Yeah. So was America at one time, and indeed the world.
Amazing. It's an amazing song as I've like reconnected with it. Kids in general get really obsessive about things, especially music. And I think like he has that gene too. So he gets really, really into it. So he's been asking, like, we've had to listen to it on the way to school, on the way home from school, multiple times. I've probably heard Thriller, I'm going to say conservatively, 30 to 40 times in the last week, right? Which is more than I've heard it for a long period of time before.
Sure. That's a unique blessing, for sure.
Yeah. It's great. Great album. You know, like MJ, obviously complicated legacy. Don't need to get into all of that, but what a song. So here's how it started and why I didn't sleep. So apparently, I found out about, 2 weeks ago or so, that somebody at his daycare showed the kids the Thriller video. And I was a little surprised.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Not sleeping either ever again.
Well, here's the thing. Like, he was kind of okay. And I was surprised. But he talked a lot about zombies and like the dancing and things like that. And I kind of thought that he had gotten over it. But like in the back of my head, he's seen the video. Right. Mm-hmm. But it's too scary for his little brother, who's 3 years old. So he kept asking me, can we watch it? And there's just never a time when you can show one thing on TV to one kid and not the other one. Right.
Right.
So last night, little brother's still in the bath, Jack's out of the tub, and he's like, Dada, can we please watch the Thriller video? And I queue it up on my phone thinking, cool, finally we get to bond over this video, right? Mm-hmm. And so he's sitting next to me on the couch, and I'm gonna share my screen and queue this up here real quick, because this is when I knew things had gone completely wrong, Kyle. We're just gonna play a little bit of this so that we don't get copyright.
Oh, did she not show him this part?
Well, yeah. So if you guys are listening and not watching, we're 2 minutes and 19 seconds into the 13-minute long, almost 14-minute version of the Thriller mini movie. And this is what we watched.
Are you all right?
Get away!
Oh, no. That image right there, one of Michael Jackson turning into a demon. He's turning into a werewolf, but for just a second, he's got yellow eyes. He's got this really bad prosthetic, like kind of werewolf teeth.
Oh, yeah.
80s special effects that are somehow more terrifying than they would be if they were modern, to my mind.
Well, yeah, because it's like a real thing in the world, right? Not like a computer image. Also, so, you know, that's how people look in Los Angeles when they've had a gluten.
A single gluten, just one. 1 ounce of white bread.
Venom, just a little bit will get you.
So he jumped, Jack jumped somehow off of his butt, like about 3 feet in the air next to me, and then was up all night because he said that there were werewolves and monsters in his room. So bad job me. Apparently at school, they showed him the zombie dancing and the music part, but not right. The entire movie, which I should have guessed at and expected. Instead, I should have the whole thing. Yeah. And now you may or may not be scarred for life. So,
but you may or may not have to listen to Thriller again 784 more times.
No, he was back at it this morning. He wants to watch the video again too.
Is he doing the dance?
His mom is trying to teach him how to do the dance a little bit. We'll kind of do some of these, like in the car, chair dancing,
yeah.
But there
you go.
Zombie arms. But he's not fully there yet. That's step number two, I suppose.
I love it. Yeah, that's going to be useful for him later.
What about you? Weekend, anything interesting? More car related than old Michael Jackson videos even?
Nope. Did not do anything car related. I didn't even go outside, really. It's hot here, turns out. Yeah. Oh, actually, that's not true. I did start to clean my garage, finally. Good. And I think my shop vac is now filled with about 9 pounds of spider web. Mm-hmm. Boy, they were having fun in there. I've yet to find any like scary ones, like no widows or anything like that, which is dope. Yeah. But I think that's because it's all like cobweb spiders, which we love because they eat all the other nasty spiders.
Sure.
But it's still like don't want to go in there and feel like you're in an Indiana Jones backlot or something.
Yeah, we should. I should share photos of my garage too, and I'll invite the viewers and listeners out there. If you have a second, either right now, share a photo of your garage. We'd love to see it and talk about it. Send us a picture of it to tips@carid.com.
Let's all bathe in our collective shame over her filthy garages. Yeah,
we've got a message. It's a little bit of a non sequitur here from Kenny Redden. Kenny, thanks for watching. Kenny says, "I crashed my motorcycle and I'm immediately worried. Kenny, are you okay? Do you need medical attention? Did you crash it just now, or
were you listening to the podcast and then like yard sailed it, or
oh no, was it the werewolf?
Yeah.
Oh, no. Michael Jackson's werewolf strikes again. This is terrifying.
But no, Kenny, I've crashed a motorcycle and it sucks, and I hope you're okay, buddy.
Yeah, I have crashed on a dirt bike when I was a child. I don't think it's the same thing. I just kind of fell over at 5 miles an hour.
Actually, technically, it wasn't a motorcycle. It was a sidecar rig, and I got T-boned by a 4Runner and launched into the air and landed in opposite traffic on a bridge. So,
oh, smokes, Kyle.
Yeah, I almost died. It was cool.
That's real.
I almost died. It was like right on that sort of that razor's edge where you're like completely fine or you die.
Yeah.
So I was fine. They CAT scanned me, and then I went home like 2 hours later, and I had a giant hematoma for a year. Other than that, right as rain. And now my knee clicks.
You have cool scars?
I have no scars. No, none.
Flawless.
No skin broken. I'm a big all the gear all the time kind of guy.
Yeah.
So I was wearing my Aerostitch Roadcrafter riding suit and my very fancy German helmet. And
nice.
It cracked all the way through, but it's pretty dope.
That's awesome. That's what it's supposed to do, right? Instead of
100%.
Yeah.
Find a picture because, you know, while we're on the topic, you know, thanks, Kenny. Yeah. For derailing the entire podcast.
No, Kenny, we appreciate it. We hope that you're okay. Please, no more crashes. And if you guys have anything else to talk about, whether it's on topic or not, hey, we're here for you. But I don't know that we have. It looks like I'm looking at our old planning doc, and I didn't have a big update like in terms of project car stuff, personal project car stuff. I did want to say I had a little bit of time over the last few days. I had a gap between cars that I was testing, so I've been spending a little bit more time in the WRX. Here's the question that's been occurring to me. And so we talked about this before when I first got the car, right? Like one of the things that I think would be fun to do would be to take the car completely back to stock, even if I keep some of the aftermarket parts that I like to see what it's like, right?
Yeah, for sure.
One thing that's always puzzled me is even cars that are older and haven't been tuned at all tend to feel more like the ride is more brittle.
Sure.
They're a little bit crashier. And some of this is just like the compression and aging of rubber parts, right? Like suspension components, bushings, engine mounts, things like that. But one thing I would love to have a conversation with somebody about, like at an OEM, Subaru even, is what is the thing that's happening in an older car to give it that feeling where it's, again, like the car is tight. It's not like anything is loose. The handling is really good. You just feel the movements on the body and especially on the suspension a lot more than you did, or at least in my memory, when it was brand new. Right. And I don't always completely understand why that thing happens so consistently with old cars that I've driven.
That's a good question. I mean, I feel like it's gotta be like the age thing. And there's so many parts in a car that contribute to that. Like, you're never going to get all the rubber.
Right.
Yeah. So, you know, who's to say, but I know exactly what you mean. Mm-hmm. I think about it all the time, particularly while driving the 911. Cause I've done things that I had hoped would kind of improve the ride and things I knew deliberately would make it worse.
Yeah.
And still the same weird noises are there.
Oh my God. So. I just saw the picture that you shared of your helmet on Instagram. You should, you can share your screen if you want. That's sure. Crazy. That's quite a helmet.
Hold on.
Yeah, man. I don't know. Like every old car that I've ever had has this to a certain extent. Like you were sort of jokingly said, like telling me about this specifically with WRX. Like, we know that tolerances get worse. Like, everything just is fitting a little bit worse after you put 100,000 plus miles on a car. And that leads to a reduction in overall kind of NVH and ride quality and things like that. But I just think that would be an interesting conversation to have, to sort of break down bit by bit what's happening to a car to make it feel that.
Yeah, for sure.
The performance is good, but
shout out chassis engineers, come on the show. But this is my helmet that it cracked all the way through.
Holy the
EPS
smokes.
Liner and everything. I'm not like the kind of person that like is like particularly sentimental, but I actually ended up writing Schubert a letter saying like, hey, your cool helmet saved my life, so thanks a lot, preach.
Do you have a new Schubert to replace it?
No, actually. Jokes on them. No, I ended up buying an Arai. In addition to having a giant head, I also have what's called a long oval head, which most helmets aren't necessarily set up to fit correctly. Okay. But Arai has sort of like a couple of different helmets that are specific to sort of oddball head shapes that are really, really comfortable. And so I bought what's called the Signet X. It was way too much money, but it fits, like, it barely feels like it's there, so I can wear it all day without getting kind of hot spots or anything like that. And it's phenomenal. And then that one's just like plain white, like my Shewrith was, because that's a safety thing. But then I got a couple of other like AGV helmets, which don't fit nearly as well, but which look way cooler. Mm-hmm. For when like I would do motorcycle reviews and I'd be on camera or something.
Sure. Yeah.
So, because you got to look cool, right? I mean, that's like 90% of riding a motorcycle.
Absolutely. I have one helmet that's I can't even remember the brand. I'm sure it's like manufactured in Asia somewhere, but it's for in car. It's not for riding. Mm-hmm. It's not meant to be a motorcycle helmet. And the fit has never been great, but this was like a sub $300 helmet that was like DOT. And what's the other big requirement? Snell rated, yeah, so that I wouldn't, like, it would be harder to kill me essentially in a crash. Yeah. But
you know what the two biggest differences between a motorcycle helmet for and an automotive racing helmet are?
My guess is one is venting, but I don't know. Nope. For sure. No.
Nope. Okay. It's the eye port size for visibility, much bigger on a motorcycle, and car helmets have to be flame retardant.
Oh, sure. Yeah, yep. Yeah.
That's the biggest ones.
That makes sense. There you go. Nope. Nobody wants a head on fire, that's for sure.
It's not ideal.
Right on. Well, so we have two kind of topics today. And I think they're going to be a lot of fun. This is just sort of, like guessing at, it's sort of pseudoscience meets, wish fulfillment, I guess. And again, like I've mentioned this at the top, but if anybody has an idea for either of the topics, we're going to start by talking about cars that we think are indestructible. We would love to have your feedback and your vision for it. So wherever you guys are watching this, if you're seeing it on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter, you can throw a comment up in the live feed wherever you're watching and we'll get it. We'll put it on the screen. If you happen to be watching this after the fact on YouTube or listening to us, you can email us or you can send us a comment and we'll answer it after the fact. So this was my proposal to you yesterday, Cal, when we were talking about the show. The question was this. If you were going to go out today, July 31st, 2024, and buy a vehicle that you needed to last you for the rest of your natural life,
mm-hmm.
however long that may be, 50, 60 years, probably in your case.
Clearly.
what car would it be? Right. And I think the thing that I didn't throw out here, and this will be interesting because you might have very different responses than me, is in my mind, I'm buying something. Well, I don't need to go into it. Like this can be new or used. I'll just leave it there. Right. Mm-hmm. And let you take it where you would. So I think we each came through and did a couple of picks. So why don't we just go ping pong style and talk about some of the cars that we would pick that we think would last our lives and why we would drive them.
Sure. Dealer's choice. You go, you know.
You go ahead. I've been talking a lot.
Well, okay then. All right. Yeah. So, my first choice, we're going to start with a new vehicle. And it's one that I love very much. It is the, wait for it. Any second. There she is. Ineos Grenadier. This car has been on my radar since it sort of was announced. I love sort of like big, dumb, old school SUVs. Like I think in general, I like specificity in vehicles. Mm-hmm. And this thing is really specific. Like it throws all kinds of like convenient, comfortable on-road features away so you can be amazing off-road. But the thing that interests me in it for this topic in particular is that it is built like a tank. Mm-hmm. It's a full like ladder frame, fully boxed ladder frame chassis. Everything is made to be worked on and repaired and like generally trail side. It's got all kinds of like provisions to like bolt stuff to it because, you know, they're thinking of overlander expedition people.
Yep.
And like, you know, it's got big slab sides. You can fix the body panels with a, you know, a hammer for the most part. It's right. Just like, it's super solid. It's not, there's not a ton of like electronic technology. I mean, which is great. It's just driving it too. It feels like a military vehicle. Like it feels indestructible. And there's not a lot of cars that are like new that feel that way. And again, that's sort of polarizing, I think, for people with this one in particular, but the Grenadier really does it for me. And the fact that I can't afford one because I'm a mortal, they're not, I mean, they're like under 100 grand, but I'm a journalist and, you know, I feel so uncool and unfulfilled, you know. It's
well, at least you've got a chance to drive one. The Grenadier is really interesting to me. And I think the first question that comes to mind when I see that pick is, I mean, on one hand, it makes absolute sense. It does look like something that could literally like withstand an apocalypse, right? Like if something went really badly in the world, you're sort of your provision for a lot of different situations in a car like that. Why would it be the Grenadier and not a G-Wagon, for instance, which seems like a car that like very directly inspired the, maybe not the current one, but like past iterations of the G-Wagon inspired the Grenadier.
I mean, the G-Wagon is rad.
Yeah.
But as it's gotten sort of more refined, I think it's gotten away from sort of that simplicity and stuff. Like you go into a new G-Wagon and it's like screen city. There's stuff everywhere. And, you know, ultimately it's a Mercedes. So
right.
You're dealing with all that Mercedes stuff when it comes to like repair and that sort of stuff. I mean, it's obviously quite robust and Mercedes doesn't even build them. Shout out Magnus Steyr in Austria. Right. Iron Shackle for life. But yeah, the Grenadier is just a simpler sort of more rugged vehicle. It's like the Reader's Digest version of the backstory is this British billionaire Sir Jim Ratcliffe.
Don't forget his honorarium, please.
I know. He was real sad and salty about the fact that Land Rover killed the old Defender and that the one that they replaced it with is like, you know, better, but not as like simple or rugged. And so he, being a billionaire, was down the pub with some mates and decided, oh, yeah, I'm just going to start a car company and make a new one. And then they went, that's what he did. And then he bought up the old smart car factory in France, and here we are. Now they have a pickup truck version as well, which I think looks weird, but
powertrain today?
It's also super interesting. It's a BMW B58, so the same thing you get in like an M340i.
Yep.
But unlike in that car, they cut one of the turbos, they lower compression slightly. Power output is down by like 100 plus horsepower, which sounds bad, but also that platform has already proven to be pretty reliable for BMW. People are pushing 1,000 horsepower through it, like with stock internals. And so by detuning it, it should last essentially forever.
Yeah.
And it's a big, heavy vehicle. And so it doesn't feel quick or fast, but it's with the 8-speed transmission, it's enough. So again, that shows that they're really kind of thinking longevity, you know, old Toyota style is a good way to put it.
Yeah, I mean, listen, man, low compression, overbuilt motors are where it's at, right? And I think we're going to see a fair... I've got two anyways, right, on my list, because that's one thing that I immediately think about, right? And one of the reasons why the Grenadier, I think, is an awesome new pick, because to your point, like, it's kind of on an island. Like, it's not doesn't really exist in the same market as mass market new vehicles, so it's not... it's not sort of bound by the same stuff that I think you and I would worry about 40 years down the road going wrong, to your point.
Right.
Like, even if Toyota or Honda, to pick examples, right, like are pretty bulletproof even in terms of their modern cars, like all the crap, all the electronic stuff that's in the car, or in many cases, like running that, you know, important systems in the car these days.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Is a little bit not even more prone to die, although that might also be true, but much more complicated to fix if you have to do it after the fact.
Well, right? And I think the infotainment and stuff like that, like obviously the Grenadier has infotainment, but it's so much less prominent and featured in that car than it is anywhere else.
Yeah.
So like if it does break, like you kind of don't care, you know, it's like, whatever, like, you know, in a situation, it's not super mission critical, I guess is the thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'll go now, and I'll go with the newest vehicle in my selection, although not a new vehicle. Though you could make an argument that there are a couple of different choices that would work here.
Mm-hmm.
Really, I think any generation of Miata is probably a worthwhile pick here. It's a little bit of a strange one because, even as like we were sort of like, you know, addressing the topic again, like saying things like if the question really was like is a car to take you through the apocalypse, then you've got a different mission than a car to last you the rest of your life. Right.
Right. Right.
But there are a couple of things that struck me when I was considering a Miata. One is just I really do think that they're really robust. So what I've got here is I've got an NC Miata, which is a car that I know like purists and people who are really advocates of MX-5 Miata, maybe it's the least favorite. Is it fair to say that this is the least favorite?
Oh, yeah. People clown on it, but I'm a fan.
I always found it really charming to drive. I got that it was maybe like a tiny bit softer and less direct than the cars that came before it. And I don't think it's nearly as sharp and good to drive as the current one. That being said, I really like the styling. I think it's super attractive. This one, you know, you and I have talked about this before as large people, like sometimes it's the specific fit of your body to a seat or a cabin. For whatever reason, the C in my memory anyways, fits me better than the current car. Like there are millimeters more room for my knees than in the current car. So I like that. And also this one, and this is probably the most important, like there are a lot of them out there. So if I was actually going to buy one today, it wouldn't be that hard to find one that had 50,000 miles or less on it, right?
No, you can pick one up for hardly anything, too.
Yeah, not a lot of money. You definitely have some budget left over for your forever car budget if that becomes a part of this. And they all go a really long time, right? I mean, I like to, there's a little bit of a correction I'm sure that happens. I always think of the, and I don't know if this is apocryphal or not, but I remember reading multiple times that like the Porsche 911 is, they're highest percentage of models still on the road as wherever produced, right?
Yeah.
And some of that is because they were built well, and some of that is just because they're very valuable cars that people really love and they want to keep on the road, right?
So yeah, for sure.
So I do think that there's an element of like we see all the time. You know, you can find on a million Reddit threads and all over forums and the internet Miatas that are over 300,000 miles, right? Not a big deal. I mean, it's a big deal. It's not, it's still the exception rather than the rule, but it's not, mm-hmm. your jaw isn't on the floor when you hear that somebody's got a 250,000-300,000 mile Miata. But I do think also it's usually a second car. It's one that people take care of. They're not commuting in it necessarily. So presumably they've lived a less hard life than other cars at that mileage too.
Yeah. And also I think, you know, the whole understressed powertrain thing comes in very much too. Like no Miata since probably, I mean, since the Mazda Speeds or whatever has really swung for the fences when it comes to specific output. Like it's not, you're not working that engine that hard, you know? And yeah, and the car's light. So everything else, you're putting less stress on everything. And so you're going through consumables and like general wear items and stuff much slower too. So it makes it easier to keep because you're not constantly like, you know, nuking tires by being 6,000 pounds or something.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a huge part of it. And then another part is that at least factored into my thinking here is how many of this thing did they make? How easy is it going to be to get spares? How much aftermarket support exists for the car, you know, again, over the next like 3-4 decades or something like that. I think Miata is like way high in the, you know, like could be one top 10 on that list all time in terms of the models. I mean, certainly they're, I'm trying to remember, I need to look it up, but I think like over 1 million on the road. I think that was a story years ago. So, you know, just like tons and tons of these on the road. And there's tremendous support, both in OEM aftermarket and then OEM and aftermarket support for the car too. So, yeah, overall. And then another big part of it is just, if this is just going to be a car that I'm going to drive for the rest of my life, do I want to drive it?
And yeah, that's for sure. That's important.
And I think that there is, you know, we talked about this in one of the earlier podcasts when I had a new Miata. It's just, it's one of those experiences that is evergreen. It's always fun to get in the car. Maybe I'd get tired of it if I was driving it day in and day out. Certainly a convertible in Michigan would be a questionable choice for a forever car, or I'd have to look after that convertible top.
Yeah.
But it is, but the driving experience is so varied and so fun in lots of different conditions that I think that it would be a great car if it was something that I was going to solo daily drive for the rest of my life. So,
and I just think Miata on studded tires, top down heat blasting, get out of here. Come on.
Oh my God.
I love it too.
Yeah. I think I've driven one on snows. I can't remember. They love to do that every once in a while in the Detroit fleet to take rear wheel drive sports cars and throw them on snow tires and then, and then hand them out to journalists. I know GM was great about that. I should say, I think GM and Ford, lots of Camaros and Mustangs over the years with that. I don't know if Mazda, I can't remember if they did or not, but it seems like a worthwhile experiment.
Yeah. I mean, I agree, obviously.
All right. You're up, man.
Whoa.
Kyle's back.
I'm back. So this seems like kind of a no-brainer pick. You know, if you've ever considered the entire continent of Africa. but yeah, here we are. The fabulous W123 Mercedes. The late 70s to kind of late 80s E-class equivalent, I guess you'd call it. You know, they have this reputation for reliability. I mean, particularly the diesels. We'll focus on the diesels. The gas ones are fine too, but and the reliability thing is maybe slightly overstated, but the longevity, that's the key, right? There, how many of these things are cruising around with 500,000 miles on them and just sort of clattering around, smoking out everybody behind them at a stoplight? Like one of my favorite examples, my in-laws have one, and they inherited it from like my father-in-law's uncle, who had like crashed it because he's old and lived in San Francisco. And so they got it like fixed, and they've just been sort of keeping it going ever since. And it's, I mean, when you say a car for the rest of your life, this is going to be the last car they ever own.
Yeah.
I mean, and they're not that old. Like I think they're like maybe mother-in-law's like 70 or something.
Sure.
So they got some time, but it just, you cannot kill them in a way that matters, right? Like there's almost nothing that you can't resurrect on these things. And Mercedes keeps parts available for these things forever. You know, I owned an old Mercedes for a long time, an even older one than this, and I could go get parts from the Classic Center. Yeah. They're just they're great. And there's something special too about Mercedes from this era. You know, they talk about doors closing like bank vaults and, you know, everything feeling solid. And this is very much kind of that era of Mercedes-Benz where the engineers were running the show. You know, I think they locked all the bean counter nerds in a closet and they just built the best cars that they could. And yeah, I mean, again, like the, and the diesel engines, they're slow. The non-turbo ones are terrifyingly slow.
Yeah.
I once test drove a 240D, so slightly older than this, non-turbocharged with a four-speed manual. And I was worried about getting up to 40 miles an hour. I had people honking at me and I'm like on the floor with it, you know?
I had a similar test drive when I was in college of a wagon, and the guy had preemptively removed the turbo because he was afraid of it failing.
Oh yeah.
And he told me that like as I was getting into test drive the car, and I was like, oh, okay. And it was still to this day the slowest car I remember driving on a highway in the United States ever. So
oh yeah, yeah. And again, that's the under stress thing. You know, even the turbo ones, like they're not quick right. at all. The transmissions are you know, decidedly lackadaisical in their shifting. They're like, okay, here's a gear, maybe, you know, kind of. But yeah, that's just you don't have to worry about whether you're going to be able to keep this thing going. It's just gonna go. Yeah. And you know, stuff like this, it does make me miss old Mercedes. Just in general, like the new cars are technologically unbelievable. Like the new S-Class is a work of art. It's everything about it is unreal. Mm-hmm. Like it's one of the few cars I've gotten in where I'm like, why aren't they charging more money for this thing? This is stupid. But the era where they could build cars like this, like the W123, where it made sense because that's what people wanted. Or that ship sailed a long time ago, and so we're not going back there. But yeah, so that's my number two pick.
Love it. Yeah, and I couldn't agree more. I mean, obviously Mercedes has a you know like oldest automaker in the world, right? Like has as long a legacy as you can have. But to my mind, you know, like boomers, Gen Xers, anyways, up until like older millennials, I think like the reputation of the brand to a certain extent was built on that generation of car, the last gasp of the engineering led Mercedes. And again, that is not to throw shade at the current company. I just think that the economic environment changed radically around like how you're able to
right.
keep your car company going, especially in the 90s, right? So,
and the definition of luxury changed a lot too. Yeah. Like there was a time where, you know, a luxury car was something that was built as well as any human could possibly build a car, right? So like I had a 1970 280 SE sedan and it was pretty technologically advanced for its time, but it was also like hand built by wizened little German men with right. like monocles and aprons, you know, like everything felt like it was, you know, the old sort of hack journalist thing, like it was made from a single block of metal kind
right.
of like it's true, that's how it felt. And then, you know, now luxury is all the gigas and doodads and technical or technological like gimmicks basically that they can throw at it, you know, and it's just where we are now, and some of that stuff's cool, but you know.
Yeah, I love all of it, but it doesn't lend itself to being a competitor and or an entrant into this conversation that we're having right
surely
now,
not right? Surely not.
But I'm really glad that you picked W123, you know, or some old Mercedes, because I think it's one, it was I had a couple on my list, and two, it is a great kind of analog to one of my picks or my next pick, which is a Volvo 240. You could have any 240 or 242 or whatever, like kind of anything from Volvo of this era, I think makes sense. The 240 wagon is my pick because of the overall just like unbeatable utility of this body shape, size, and overall packaging of the car.
I had three of them.
Yeah, well, I've never owned one. I guess I owned one. That's not completely true. I owned one in concert with some friends, or had access to one and a very old my very first ever car website, actually, that we'll talk about at another time. that I drove around a bit, but these were so thick on the ground in Western Michigan, like where I grew up, especially, you know, elementary school, middle school, late 80s, early 90s, that everybody had one. Like, I've driven this car a million times. There's nothing. It's so weird because I don't even know where 240 is right now culturally. I think it's kind of somewhere in the last 10 years, this car has turned into like a recognizable style icon in a weird mm-hmm. way. Like, the people that I know who have them and drive them regularly now are less car people. Although there are still plenty of car people that have old Volvos, especially.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
But there are lots of like architects, you know, like artists and, you know, like sort of style leaders that I know that are into this car, partially because of this very extreme blocky styling, which was sort of the anti-styling statement, I think, of the time. So for one, I just think this is going to be a cool thing for kind of the rest of the time that I'm alive to have mm-hmm. park in your driveway. And, you know, people know that you're being intentional if you roll up in a, this is a 1990, I think, that I found on Bring a Trailer or Cars and Bids. But
if you show me the rear window glass, I could tell you.
I have other pictures. I don't know that we have one of the rear glass, but, and obviously a well-loved example too, as we look at the interior, you can tell that this thing is, I mean, it just looks like every one that I ever was ever in. Right. Like,
shout out blue vinyl interiors. I mean,
man. So good. I didn't love the, I would, if I bought one today, I would probably buy one with the dorky, blocky airbag, like world's first airbag steering wheel, but I don't like it as much as the original one. But yeah, man. So again, like this is a 2.3 liter inline four. I don't even know.
B230 is the engine code.
Yeah. I mean, it makes no power. It's under no stress at all. It is getting nowhere in a hurry. But like beautifully, kind of famously reliable. Everybody says, you know, it's kind of the standard line. If you do standard maintenance on this car, if you're doing your oil changes and, you know, like replacing your consumables, checking your rubber and that sort of thing as you need to, they literally give you badges. Volvo has badges ready to send you to put on your grill if you hit 300,000, 400,000, half a million, I think even a million miles, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure.
Because it regularly happens. So there's a ton of brand equity in the entire Volvo brand today that was created from the 240s just lasting forever. So I think I had to show one of the, so I don't have the rear glass here. I'm showing the tailgate, just this gigantic cargo area of what is not a very big car. I mean, it's really narrow relative to modern cars. But long and, you know, just a big square opening lets you do a whole lot of things.
Yeah, for sure. It's, They're massive. I've like had to move apartments several times, you know, when I had 240s, and I wasn't making nearly as many trips as I thought.
Yeah.
There's so many other like weird quirks too. So like the under that like spare tire thing, you could get a jump seat. So it's like rear facing jump seat, which seems super cool. Except like it's the most un-Volvo thing ever because that crat is a crumple zone. Like, so you're putting people in the crumple zone. Yeah, they're so good. Like, they're just so great. And I've never found a car, I mean, they're super easy to work on, apart from anything involving the heating system. Like, Volvo literally built the entire car around the heater core. Like, you know, you're going to change a heater core out, it's going to look like the Blues Brothers mobile after it falls apart, like, in your garage. But yeah, they're great. And you can make them handle, and like, they just will do anything. They're just nice. They're just nice to drive, man.
Yeah, really. Yeah. And again, some of this is just down to them being slow, right? But smooth, quiet until they get really old. And you need to replace all the rubber. Very solid, tremendous like feeling. Not sporty in any way, shape, or form. You can get the manual. This is one of the cars where, honestly, I guess I would prefer to get a manual if everything else was equal. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't really bother me to drive the automatic because I'm not going to do anything particularly racy with the car anyways.
Right.
But just would be super fun. I want to throw Bruno up on the screen. Hello, Bruno. Thank you for participating. And Bruno is asking about a Camry wagon. Well, we got a little typo there, but a Camry wagon, which is
an excellent choice as well.
Awesome pick. I grabbed a quick screen of one that I can share. I don't know how many generations they made this car, or at least made them and sold them in the US, because it,
I think like one.
It was a really rare car over here. And Bruno, I don't know where you're watching from or writing us from, but these were awesome. And every time I see this, and I see, I believe it's like a third gen Honda Accord that had that same kind of jelly bean shape, really cool glass house, I get really into them. But this would be an amazing pick. I think any Toyota Camry would be an amazing pick for a car to drive for the rest of your life, to be honest with you. And to all the criteria that we set up before, the older the better in terms of being able to do stuff yourself and have it be slightly uncomplicated, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely. Awesome. Those things are phenomenal. The engines are great, the interiors last forever, you know. So I grew up in the Northwest, and so like these, I saw these not infrequently. You know, Volvo, again, 240 Volvos everywhere, absolutely everywhere. And, you know, because like the Seattle area is something about, like, they don't salt the roads, there's not a lot of sun, and so it just like perfectly preserves cars. And so you'd see just like museum spec Toyota Camry wagons cruising around, like, you know, like it was nothing. And yeah, these things are great. Good call, Bruno.
Good call, Bruno. Yeah, man, I remember my first trip ever out west. I ended up in Portland with a friend. We did a road trip out there, and I was amazed just walking around the streets of Portland, seeing all of this, like, early, all these early Japanese cars that I kind of knew, but if they existed around me, they were completely rusted out, mm-hmm. and they were just pristine everywhere throughout Portland, and obviously being driven on the regular. So,
conversely, the first time I went to Detroit, and like saw the stuff that's driving around on the highway, like they're like little holes in everything. I was like, what is this Mad Max horse shit? Like, this is unbelievable. Like, how is this allowed? I was like, oh wait, never mind, everything's like that. And there's also, you know, 1 million Pontiac Aztecs, like,
and no regulations, so you don't need to do any sort of maintenance to keep your car on the road other than pay your tag fees once a year and keep your license up to date. So eventually we should really work on that, I think, honestly. Yeah. Like, there are a lot of very unsafe broke back old pickup trucks around Detroit that make me nervous, but
Gretchen, so, let's get that sorted, you know.
Yeah, it's she doesn't want to impose on anybody's freedom to have a horrible crash on the freeway. not to get
damn it.
All right, I think you're up, Kyle. What do you got next?
So Bruno unknowingly set the tone for this next pick, because we've entered the black hole of old Toyotas.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going with the first gen Tundra.
Yeah.
Again, I see them all the time. I see them constantly overloaded with like 3 million metric tons of scrap metal and like old lawn clippings and stuff like that. You know, they just keep going, and they have that absolutely incredible, you know, early Toyota V8. That just goes on and on and on. They're infinitely repairable, and I even think they look kind of cool.
Such, you know, a cool looking truck. Yeah.
Yeah, they're great. They just, and like, they sold a zillion of them. So like, you just, this is like the Toyota that I love, right? Like, it's not Supras and Celicas and what, like, it's, I love the like caveman spec like Land Cruisers and Tundras and 4Runners that like they just go forever, you know. And this one is even a great color. This is, I think, it's an old press photo, but yeah, I mean, you can't have like a car you keep forever and not talk about Toyota.
Old,
you know,
old trucks in general, old Toyota. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're gonna, spoiler alert, there's gonna be another Toyota before we're done with this topic, no surprise. So we have absolutely entered the Toyota portion of the program. Weirdly, or not weird, I haven't actually seen a lot of first gen Tundras. There are a fair number of like 10-year-old Tundras mm-hmm. around, but I think it took a lot longer in the mid for Toyota to make penetration into the Midwest with Tundra. Tacoma was
for
always
sure.
owned the market, because the small trucks and mid-sized trucks were just kind of abandoned after a while by the big three. Mm-hmm. But obviously, Ford, GM, you know, Chevy and GMC and Ram like owned it, and you just like see 40 F-150s for every one Tundra you see in that generation anyway. So
true. I mean, well, the West Coast is sort of Toyota's home turf, or was,
yeah,
still kind of, but like, yeah, I mean, it never it was always sort of a choice. I talked about this a little bit in my sort of more recent Tundra review that I did for car80.com/drive. But it never really had to compete with the big three kind of on the same playing field. Mm-hmm. You know, like the people that were looking were generally like shopping for Tundras at that time, were like they wanted something else, or they wanted a Toyota specifically, and they're like, oh well, now I can just have this flavor of Toyota. And like now that's sort of changed somewhat, so the Tundras is sort of playing up against like the Ram 1500, the Silverado, and the F-150. But yeah, back in these days, it was just sort of a, you know, letting its freak flag fly. And by freak flag, I mean incredibly boring, like, you know, white milk toast, super snoozy, reliable flag that we all love.
Toyota also has the amazing ability to pull part. And I don't know, you probably do, but off the top, I don't know whether or not there are a lot of sort of global parts and pieces in that Tundra. That made it easier to scale. But Toyota has such a tremendous, not just in Japan, but all over the world, like network of products that they've created for a very, very long time, especially when you're talking about like workaday, off-road, overlanding type stuff, mm-hmm. that they were able to package that up in ways for North America, both under Toyota and Lexus badges, that gave them sort of instantly reliable products under the skin that they were then able to tailor for a US audience in a US market.
Yeah, for sure.
Some of the brilliance of their truck and SUV stuff.
Yeah. I mean, like the 1UZ or the 3UZ V8, mm-hmm. whatever the V8 was, like it saw service in the Land Cruiser. I think it was in the Land Cruiser Prado for a while. Like it's just the Lexus, you know, it was just everywhere in everything. And it was such a known quantity. That, like, of course it worked in this application. So yeah, like they, you know, they do have a really great parts bin to pull from for that kind of thing. So excellent point.
So we're gonna round out with my last pick here, another Toyota, that we've basically said everything that needs to be said, like on this front too. And I, in our spreadsheet, in our planning doc, I wrote any 4Runner really, but what I've got here is I happen to be partial to the second gen 4Runner.
Same.
This is a 95. I think they're great. You could still get this one with a manual transmission. And I do think like when you're doing any kind of like off-roading or something, that can be really handy. Same basic idea as everything that we just talked about with the Tundra, right? And really it hits the playbook everywhere for this entire conversation, right? Like low stress, yeah. Everything has been tested a million different ways in every market. You know, like you've got an incredibly durable frame, springs, you know, all of the parts, that anything that could break catastrophically on this car was sort of fixed 40 years ago before they even put it into production, right?
It's funny you say springs, because I can't remember the last time I saw one of these that wasn't sort of like Carolina squat, like, because like the rear springs or shocks or whatever would always go, and so they were just like always like just slumping in the back. So.
That's fair. But it's also like, again, like with the support to fix that, no pun intended, exists like crazy. Huge community around these vehicles.
Oh, too. Yeah.
And they sold 1 billion of them to date. So there's just a tremendous amount of support for it. And then you've got sort of where we started to with the Grenadier too. If it's something that you're driving all of the time, right? Like what can't you do in an old 4Runner other than win a race?
Right.
Or not spend all your remaining income on gas, I guess is another small problem. Yeah. But
I mean, bonus points for being able to roll the rear window down.
Party mode.
That's like a unique sort of Toyota thing. You can do that in the new Tundra too. And is it useful? Not really. Do I love it? You bet your ass I do. It's great. Absolutely.
It's like if you needed to set up an ambush in 1995 in a squirt gun fight you're having with your friends, like a 4Runner rear window was your friend.
So you effectively turned the old 4Runner into like a water pistol, like technical, like
that's right. That's right.
The water pistol Taliban or something.
We may or may not have used that tactic in the heyday of super soaker culture. I don't know if anybody's parents approved of that, because water did make its way into the vehicle for sure, but I digress.
Mm-hmm. There's going to be casualties. What are you going to do? Victory has a price.
That's right. Freedom ain't free, buddy. All right. So that was good. I think that there are, I think that's a pretty good selection of cars that would last forever. Honestly, any one of those picks, yours or mine, I would be more than happy to have in my decrepit garage for the rest of my, my years. And honestly, I think they would probably outlive the garage at this point. So it's good job us on that.
Yeah. We nailed it.
Absolutely killed it. Well, we've been yammering on for a little bit here. We did want to talk a little bit about what we do when we buy a used car. This is something we've talked about a lot, right? Like, I've been through this process. You've been through this process a million times. Mm-hmm. So you brought up the great idea that maybe we'd chat through some things that are sort of our must do after we buy a used car to sort of get things off on the right foot, to get the car sorted and get ourselves sort of with the project.
Yeah, for sure. I'll start if you don't mind.
Yeah, please.
My biggest one, and I struggled to find a really good image for this, so sorry, deal with my face. But interior detail. Oh my god! Even like somebody who like keeps their car in reasonable condition, like I am immediately grossed out by getting into somebody else's like slime pit of a car, just with like DNA it's gross. It's the worst. Yeah. And I'm not great about keeping the exterior of my car clean. It always feels like what do they call that? A Pyrrhic victory. It's like you your car is clean, but at what price?
Right.
And for how long? But the interior, like I'm super serious about it. I like, you know, detailing the interior of a car. So like, yeah, I mean, get in there, wipe everything down, pull the mats out, vacuum, get, you know, into all the cracks and crevices, and change the pollen filter. It's a big one that people forget often. And that's the first thing I do. Like, I get excited about it when I'm shopping for cars. I'm like, oh, I can clean this thing up. It'll be so exciting, and then it'll look like it's new inside. Like when I bought the X5, I think it took me the better part of a day to clean the interior of that. It was a little rough.
Yeah.
But now it looks sweet.
Well, you also get the great feeling, I think, if you just buy a car that's in reasonable mechanical condition or acceptable to you mechanical condition, but somebody just has trashed the interior and you spend a day getting that cleaned up, I always feel like I'm already ahead of the game right now, right? Like, I could change my mind tomorrow and I could probably make a little bit more money than what I just spent on the car because I put a little bit of attention into getting it cleaned up. So I'm with you 100%. I also like to do this. I will cop to the fact that, this happened when I bought the Mercedes that I just got rid of. It was the guy who owned it before smoked in it like every third Saturday or something on his way to go see a movie with his wife. So there was like a cigarette smell in it, but it was not like a smoker car overpowering smell.
Right. Right.
So I had that, I brought that car in and had it detailed, like professionally detailed, and they ran, the ozone machine through it. And it was so satisfying to get back into it because it really did. One, I can do a pretty good job. I can do like an A job for a dad, I think, in detailing a car, but I'm not in the same category as somebody who does it for a living professionally either. And it just feels awesome to have that. It felt so great to have that car clean and smelling so much better, even when they just smell clean, right?
It becomes a place you want to be, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I bought myself like a little carpet extractor and everything, because what's more exciting than getting like a gallon of disgusting black filth water out of a car and being like, not anymore, not today. Mm-mm. And then I also keep the interiors of my cars really clean, just in general. Like, I try not to eat in them. I don't put trash anywhere that I don't throw away like immediately after, that kind of stuff. So, yeah. I'm like vaguely Howard Hughes-y about car interiors, but that's my cross to bear, I guess.
I like it. I'm almost there. I'm just in the habit of driving press cars for such a long time where, you know, that you've got to give it back. You get, I think you build better habits about not eating, not doing stuff that you know is going to like potentially really damage an interior. And then when it's your own, it's even better.
Yeah.
I will say when you have kids, like some of that goes away, not because you don't want to, the job just becomes bigger to clean up after them. When it's, you know, like early March in Michigan and you've got to like get into and out of the same car, like with kids with muddy boots, like it's not it's not as feasible to keep it looking great day in and day out. But once a week, you can go through and wipe it down and do the carpets and get it looking pretty good. Mm-hmm. So the only thing, so I'll piggyback on that with my first one on my list, because it's a little bit the same, is I like to just get the easy stuff knocked out right away, right? So
sure.
So fixing the easy stuff on a new car, and I do mean easy, where it's like you've got the stuff that you buy and you see a little bit of value in the car because somebody hasn't been willing to put that effort into it, right? So
sure.
if there are warning lights on, but you know that it's sort of a simple fix, you know it's not actually something that's going to require like a big diagnostic effort. You know, like I've had blown fuses on cars before that are obviously pretty easy to take care of. To your point about the interior, and I didn't add this one as a specific one, it could be its own thing. Like, does the car need new floor mats? Can you either
that's a good one.
Figure out, like, fix the existing carpeted floor mats, or can I get like a new set of, again, around here, like rubber floor mats that I can throw in so that I don't have to worry about it with kids or with weather, things like that. Floor mats are a really easy one to take care of. And then like other smaller maintenance items that, you know, are not going to be like a big job that are, you know, a couple hours or an hour or less to get that knocked out, because then right away you feel like you're starting from, you're starting back from zero as opposed to all the issues that you've got.
Absolutely. That's a good one. That's a really good one. Floor mats. Yeah. Anything where it's like the highest part or the biggest lift for the process is whipping out the credit card. I'm in favor of for right. sure.
Yeah, that I've got one of those. I don't know. It's. I need to replace like the lip. It's an aftermarket lip on the on the chin spoiler of the WRX. But I know that's like a super easy one to do, and it's cracked. And it's like one of those things that you kind of look forward to, where you're like, oh, that'll actually make me feel so good.
Oh yeah,
so a little effort just to knock that out. So,
100%, absolutely.
All right, so the easy stuff is taken care of. Your car is very clean. What are you doing next?
So when I buy a car, I tend to be kind of a stickler for cars with service history.
Mm-hmm.
It's the kinds of cars that I buy, European ship boxes. not buying a car with service history is like, it's like being blindfolded and running through a land minefield. It's just not a good idea, right? And so I tend to, if a car comes with like a big pile of service records, I will go through and I will digitize them. Sometimes, I don't have a scanner anymore, but I used to do that. But now, I'll go through. This is great because I bought this. This is my 911, obviously. And I bought it from an ex-SpaceX engineer. And he kept an even more insanely detailed spreadsheet than I did. Than I usually do. And so, like, we've got, mileage. The date that service was performed, cost, the part itself, who did it, which is funny because it was him.
That's amazing.
Oops. but yeah, like that kind of thing. And then because it's so much easier than like digging through a pile of receipts, right? Like it's a lift initially, but it also helps me like keep track of stuff. Like I can set myself reminders and things. And I tend to really be pretty persnickety about this kind of stuff, about maintenance and not only like doing the thing, but like what specific parts are going into it. So like, did I replace the trans oil with Motul, or did I use the Porsche branded fluid, or that kind of stuff? Like that's sure. important to me. And so yeah, that's like usually my big second step. And I also find it like kind of embarrassingly satisfying, like it's real sort of like deep nerd meditation stuff. just throw on a record and just start, filling out cells in a spreadsheet. Feels good, man.
It is. It's the analog to like checking off, making a list, a to-do list in the morning, and then being able to cross everything off of it. Right. Like you just feel like things are right in the world. I've got
first item on the list, make list. That's all he's got to do.
So the spreadsheet is amazing. And the best used car I ever bought on this, probably the best car I ever used car I ever bought, period, was the E46. I think I always forget if it's an 03. I think it was an 03 ZHP, E46 BMW. And I bought it from Mike Harley, who is was in PR, was an automotive journalist before that in Los Angeles. And so it was one of those things where the car was owned almost its entire life by his best friend from New, right? Best friend was like you and like the SpaceX engineer, had everything like in a giant shareable Google sheet, like all of the services that he performed, literally exactly like you had there. He may have even had some photos embedded in the spreadsheet to show things that were visual and important, right? So Harley bought the car from him with his son, intending to turn it into kind of a first car slash autocross car for his son. And for whatever reason, they just didn't get around to it. It ended up building a GTI instead. So I was technically the third owner, but it only belonged to Harley on a trailer next to his garage for a year or a number of months or something like that. And getting that, in addition to, you know, when we shipped the car over, I opened it up and it had, you know, a box full of boxes, oil filters and you know, like BMW fluids and just spare parts that he had for the car. We had a BMW car covered, like all that stuff organized. It just like, one, it just makes you feel really good about the fact that you made a smart purchase decision. And then two, it kind of gets you more stoked about the car in a weird way.
Oh, yeah.
You know? Having that all labeled, I was always the kid. I liked getting the toys that had lots of accessories with them too, because I thought that was super cool. And I feel the same way about cars right now. When they come with other stuff, especially used cars, part of the history, and you get to sort of add to that and then eventually like hand that over. Makes me feel good about owning it. And it makes me know that I'll feel better when I have to sell it too. So
yeah, for sure. Absolutely. It's always also an interesting thing too. Like if you get, you know, a couple of jugs of coolant or something, you know, it also gives you kind of like a little sneak peek into like what you might want to give extra special attention to if you buy a car, you know, especially with a BMW of that era where everything's plastic.
Right.
Not that I would know anything about that after owning an E39 and now an E53. Yeah, for sure. That kind of stuff gives me just a warm, fuzzy feeling 100%.
All right. So the next item on my list is just putting new tires on a car. Right. And to be honest, I think that every car I've ever purchased since I had like a job, I put new tires on, even when it didn't specifically need tires, right? And there are a couple of reasons for that. One is, and I think this is the biggest one, most people who don't care about driving a whole lot just buy cheap tires that fit on the wheels that they have.
Oh yeah, definitely. Right?
So in many cases, the tires are just like, even if they have great tread, you know, or are not that old, are just not what I would have selected. So I can live with that up to a point until I can't, and then I need to get something else. And then again, being in a cold weather state, being in a snowbelt state, there's an inflection point every year, if it's a car that you're driving, to do this anyways. And that's like, you want to buy either new snow tires or like buy a first set of snow tires and potentially wheels for the car too, right?
I love snow tires so
much. It's so much fun. Like there's nothing, I am eternally not frustrated, but a little stupefied by people who get, they just think tires are the most boring thing in the world, even if they kind of care about cars, because it's so transformative. Like you can take any car that you love or a car that you don't particularly like and like radically change the rubber that's on it and have a very different experience driving the car. And I find that endlessly fascinating. Part of this is just like, I don't have a whole lot of like deep engineering knowledge of how, like, you know, rubber chemistries and patterns and things like that. It does seem like a black art to me that you can have two brand new snow tires or, you know, like performance tires, and they can just sound and have different feel and really different behaviors and sort of like performance envelopes. I find that really fascinating. But so the point at which I get to, quote unquote, buy new tires for my new car is always like one of the things that I'm most excited for, because I know I'm going to get to have that moment of getting in it and be like, oh, wow, this is what you're like now, right?
This is what this car was meant to be.
Exactly. For sure. Yeah.
Well, I mean, talking about people not finding tires interesting, like I get it. They're big, expensive pieces of rubber that you have to replace more often than you'd like, usually. Right. But they're the most important and most transformative part of your car, because they're the only part of your car that actually touches the road. Tires are everything. And I think, and there's so much difference, like subtle difference between like brands and models too. Mm-hmm. So like going from when I bought my 911, it had Bridgestone Potenza Sports, which were great. They had plenty of grip, but like it felt like the sidewalls were made of plywood. which was not great on a, you know, already low, kind of not that supple sports car. And then it went to Michelin's, and then, you know, like the grip level is a little bit different. The way the breakaway characteristics are a little bit different, but the sidewalls were sweet.
Yeah.
And now it feels like a different car because it's more comfortable and it's more fun to get out and drive. And I'm not thinking about, like, you know, having my spine ruined going over, like, you know, a pothole or something. Yeah, it's awesome. I hate buying tires only because they're so expensive. They're so good. Tires especially are like prohibitively expensive.
The cost has gotten completely out of hand. And, you know, like, especially part of this too is just like we're all driving around on much larger wheels than we used to as well.
True.
And like taller, wider wheels need a wider tire, more rubber, and they're able to charge more for it too. And listen, like, you know, our retail sidecar ID, like, we sell a lot of tires. So obviously, like, we've got a vested interest in this too. But like, I think this, we come about this pretty honestly. Like, it's, I say that it's it is an expense, but like, how often do you spend even a couple grand if you're buying, you know, expensive, like nice performance tires or snow tires or something like that, that mm-hmm. have such a dramatic effect on the overall safety of you and whoever else you put on your car in your car?
Absolutely. Right? Yeah. Yeah. For sure.
So it's a tremendous investment. And anybody who's ever heard the sound of my voice before is probably already tired of me talking about having the right tires on in the winter, because they don't want to spend the money on it. And I understand, but I'm like, I love you and I don't want you to die. And even if you think you can go because you have all wheel drive, you can't stop. So, and man, do I want you to stop.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember the first, the Pacific Northwest didn't really get a lot of snow historically. And then I remember like the first year we got like a couple of really big snowstorms. And so we always would be on all seasons, right? Because it would get down into like the 30s and or 40s or whatever, and then but it would just stay there and you wouldn't get snow or ice or anything like that.
Yeah.
And then I bought my first set of Blizzaks for, I had a 1998 Volvo V70 T5, and I put Blizzaks on it, and I was just like, oh my god, like, you know, I'd see like massive like four-wheel drives with big chunky tires just in a ditch, and I'm just motoring past like whatever, losers. Yeah. snow tires are great. Now I don't have to buy, I only have to have summer tires now, which is a beautiful thing. So it's Michelin PS4Ss all year round for old Kyle J. Hyatt.
I love it. I love it. I mean, I love that for you too, as much as I do enjoy also, you know, I'm looking forward to snow season. By the way, last year we got two or three big snowy days around here, but I'm looking forward to putting some new snow tires on the WRX and just spending a day going out and playing in them.
Hell yes.
All right, let's power through. We're going well. We're over an hour, anyways. I'm happy for those of you still hanging along. Tires is me. All right, what's your last one? Your last used car tip, the thing that you must do when you buy a used car.
And this one is a big one, and it's sort of like an umbrella thing, and super important for me again with my penchant for, you know, crappy European cars, is just doing the deferred maintenance. Like 99% of the time, if you bought a car from somebody that wasn't a fellow like insane person,
right,
there's going to be a bunch of stuff that just didn't get done because it didn't seem that important, or it was slightly too expensive or whatever. And for me, like, if I buy the car, I'm already in the like, well, I'm hemorrhaging money mindset, so I might as well, you know, dig my grave a little deeper and just do the oil change, check the brakes, flush the brake fluid, do the coolant, all that stuff. And luckily, like, I'm in a position where I can do that myself mostly. Yeah. But again, like, it's just one of those things where like you buy a car, you don't know if you can trust it or not, but going through that process, you know, like, I don't have to worry about this and this, so now I can go have fun in it, right? And like, that's a big one for me.
I think the trust part is huge too, right? Like, as people who are, you know, like, I think that it's wise to be a little skeptical of anybody that you buy a used vehicle from, even honestly if it's somebody that you're related to, if you weren't a party to the maintenance going up to it,
right?
Just because better safe than sorry, especially where those critical safety systems are concerned, right?
So
yeah, being able to get that out of the way, having the peace of mind that it was done correctly and that, you know, you are up to snuff, again, tires, braking, like certainly like all of the engine maintenance and things like that are important too. The stuff that like keeps me from getting into a wreck is what I really care about here. And so that is makes me feel really confident to go out and drive the car as it was intended.
Yeah, and there's also like a saving myself from embarrassment element as well. Like when you quote unquote do cars for a living, to have your like piece of crap BMW break down on the side of the freeway and have to like call AAA for a tow, like someone's gonna hear about that and you're gonna get chirped for it. Like you're gonna get clowned on, and I don't need that in my life. Like, you know, my life is challenging enough.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to stay off of people's radar when it comes to that. So
I've long since
AAA premium membership with 200 miles of towing in a year. I actually ran out of that and free tows in a year with my Mercedes, like the first year I owned it.
So. I'm sure that you were being clowned on with love, number one, and maybe even a little bit of jealousy, but 200 miles of towing in a year is a fair amount. Of course, you live in Los Angeles too. It's rare that when I have breakdowns that I'm that far from home because I never go anywhere.
Right.
Yeah, deferred maintenance is an awesome one. The last one on my list is a little bit, it's more fun. It's like we were talking about, this isn't like something that I would recommend as a must do for anybody who buys a new car, but it's really important for me. And that's take the car on like a significant road trip, right? So maybe this is the cherry on top of the hard work Sunday that we've assembled here so far with what we're doing with the used car. But, you know, you and I love cars because we like driving them at the end of the day, right? I mean, yeah, I like them as objects and I like looking at them too, I suppose. But what I really want to do is get behind the wheel and drive it somewhere and have that experience. And so being able to go, especially for me, where I have to go kind of out of my way to have like to find a better road to drive, you know, like it's great to make even if it's a half day, right? Or a Monday road trip. Doesn't even necessarily have to be overnight. Go out somewhere for a couple of hours, spend some time driving the car in a place that's fun, whether that's, you know, again, like a great road or on a racetrack or off-roading it somewhere, depending on what the vehicle is, and then coming back. That's so satisfying to have that kind of like full experience of it and I just feel like that's the time when it starts to feel like this is really my thing and it doesn't belong to the previous owner anymore. It's not just a stranger in my garage. It's actually my car. So.
Right. And also that trust thing too, right? Like this is like the first date with the new partner, right? Like you're feeling it out. You're kind of getting an idea of what's, you know, what you're in for. And that's exciting too. So yeah, 100%. Even if it's, going two towns over to get donuts from this weird place or, you know, 1,000 miles to wherever. Like, absolutely.
The only bad one I ever had was actually the first car I ever owned. I was 15 or I didn't have my license. I was 16. I didn't even have my license. But for whatever reason, my dad had to drive it back. And it was a 1987 Toyota minivan, the one they call the Space Egg before pre-Previa. The guy who owned it before me was using it as a pickup truck, basically. So it had no seats in the back. And I was so excited as we were driving home. Safety was not number one on my dad's list, obviously. No. But at some stoplight or something, I jumped into the back just out of sheer exuberance for the car. And I got a giant hunk of glass shoved into my knee. Because he had construction materials back there.
No.
That was, I don't know if that counts as the real first road trip. That van didn't last very long for me, but it was the one time that I felt burned by the experience, but it's been smooth sailing for me since then.
To sort of round it out, I had that 1970 Mercedes, and my wife and I, we tried to drive it to Santa Barbara like three times, and the car completely crapped the bed every single time. We never made it out of LA County. And then I remember like the first time I got it back after almost having the entire engine rebuilt, like the whole top end came off. I had to get a new cylinder head, all this stuff. And like the first time I drove it to all the way to Santa Barbara was for a Lexus program, like 4 or 5 years after I bought the car. And I pulled into, it was like the Four Seasons Bacara or something. Like it's a really nice place.
Yeah.
In my beautiful classic Mercedes. Like I get out and I'm like basically doing the Rocky on the steps. Like, so pumped, like screw you Santa Barbara, I own this place.
By the third trip though, was your wife like, should we just go to the movies or like around the corner or something?
She like got into it. She's like, we're gonna do this. Like she's very kidding. She's more intense than I am, I think.
Okay. So,
so it became like a point of a real sticking point for us with that car, and we love that car to death, but sold it about a year and a half ago because I just wasn't driving it. I had press cars and stuff all the time. So shout out to the pediatrician doctor who bought it and now uses it to commute from the Hollywood Hills to the Pasadena Children's Hospital or whatever. So
doing good work, taking care of the kids and the Mercedes, let's hope. This is fun. This was a really fun episode. I love that list. I want to thank everybody for watching and for the comments today. We appreciate it greatly. I'll throw out there again, if you guys are watching on YouTube, please subscribe to our channel. I know that we've got a lot of old videos on the Car ID channel. We're trying to make new stuff. We're doing this podcast every week. You guys can tune in and see us live at Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Pacific.
Crushed it.
Yeah. 1 p.m. Eastern time. We will be here with fresh content for you. If you are listening to us after the fact, you can and subscribe, leave us a review. We would love all of that stuff as we're trying to grow this thing and get more people to listen. We appreciate you all. Kyle, I appreciate you. Thanks for chatting today.
Oh, thanks, pal. I appreciate you too. And I apologize to all the Brett stands out there. You know, he'll be back soon. Don't worry about it.
Brett is the first man to go AWOL from the Project Scars podcast.
And we won't forget it.
Never. We're racking him up and he's down one. I'm sure we'll miss an episode one time or another.
Probably when I'm dead. I got nothing.
All right, guys. We'll see you next Wednesday. Peace.
Yep. Vaya con Dios.
I know. I don't know what's happening.